Here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discuss during the Super Terrific Happy Hour should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, to say nothing of super and terrific, of course, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show.
People always tell me, you should have your money working for you. Because you send your money out there working for you, a lot of times it gets fired. You go back there, what happened? I had my money, it was here, it was working for me. Yeah, I remember your money. We had to let him go.
Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Super Terrific Happy Hour. Joining me, as always, is the Super Terrific Stephanie Pomboy. Hi, how are you?
I'm fabulous. Super and terrific. How are you?
I am just dandy. I'm dandy. I'm down in Australia dodging snakes and seeing my daughter. So one half of that is making me very happy and the other half very nervous, which is how I live my life at the moment, unfortunately.
You're sleeping with one eye open.
Exactly right. Yes. Exactly right. Well, look, I don't know what the hell we're going to talk about. It's just everything's so quiet and peaceful lately. It's really nice to have very little going on in the way of trouble in the financial system, Steph.
It's really quiet. It's like watching paint dry out here. I don't know.
Ain't that the truth? Well, listen, I figured what we could start talking about is this little bank in Silicon Valley, which went to the wall the other week, because the reason it went to the wall was pretty predictable. And someone I know who has been talking about this for quite some time has been warning that this was exactly going to happen for quite some considerable period before it actually did. And that person is one S. Pomboy, founder and president of Macro Mavens.
Oh, my gosh.
So
I think that you probably said it long before I said it, and I just regurgitated it in very lowbrow fashion without the British accent to boot. So,
well, I find that not to be the case. But listen, it was such a predictable problem, and all joking aside, this is something that you have been warning about for such a long time, that the speed of these rate hikes and the danger that not the level they got to, but the pace at which they were kind of cascading down upon the financial system was going to cause problems. You identified that chart that you showed me a couple of months ago now, I think, of all the unrealized mark-to-market losses on the bonds. I remember at the time when you showed me that, which was long before it began doing the rounds, neither of us could really fathom quite what was going on in that chart. So talk a little bit about finding that chart and the kind of detective work you had to do afterwards.
Well, as ever, it takes very little detective work to do what I do. You know, I consider myself master of the obvious, and I get down on my knees every day and thank the powers above that there's so many people who seem to be oblivious to the obvious, and it has created this tremendous opportunity for me to highlight things that are really front and center. So that chart came from the FDIC. You know, the amazing thing is that They have a quarterly, I'm a nerd, so I get all these, I subscribe to the FDIC's quarterly banking bulletin, and it gives you all of that information. And that chart was featured in that quarterly report, which, of course, not only does the FDIC have access to and regular folks like you and me, but in theory, the Federal Reserve should be looking at this, you'd think, once in a while. So anyway, it just, all this information is readily available and out there. And for some reason, no one really focused on it. And I think the reason why is, as you said, we had these massive, the speed and magnitude of the rate hikes was unprecedented. And so we did build up enormous unrealized losses in the treasuries and agencies, the risk-free securities that the banks were required to hold. And honestly, I don't think that really was a story, because no one ever imagined those losses would have to be realized. So I think everyone probably, maybe they weren't aware of the magnitude of the losses, but they probably just figured, well, this isn't an issue we're ever going to have to deal with, because, what, we'd never have a situation where a bank would actually have to liquidate their treasury and agency portfolios to meet outflow, deposit outflow. Well, lo and behold, that ended up happening. And then the amazing thing is when you go back and you look at obviously what happened at Silicon Valley Bank, you know, had some unique aspects of it because of their specific customer base. But they watched their deposit base wither for months and months and months and did nothing about it. And that is something that pertains to the entire banking system. If you look at the total deposit situation in the banking system, deposits are actually declining year on year for the first time, I think, since the 1970s. So this is really a big deal. And it's totally avoidable. If banks weren't so greedy and they just raised deposit rates, people wouldn't be running out to buy T-bills. So, you know, I think people just imagine we never get to this day, but they also probably didn't realize that the banks were being so, I don't know, they were dismissing what seemed to be clearly a problem.
But you made the point, and I want to make sure you make it again here, because it was such a great one. When you talked about, you know, obviously raising deposit rates would crush their NIMs, which is a big problem for them, obviously. However, you made a fantastic point about why they would allow this gap to build up between deposit rates and money market funds and T-bills, not just for a month or 3 months or 6 months, but so just talk about that, because I think that's a really, really important part of this that I haven't heard anybody else talking about.
Well, I mean, maybe it sounds like a crazy thesis, but it just seemed to me like they must have imagined if the you know whatever hit the fan that they would get bailed out. And that moral hazard, that attitude is now being reinforced by the bailouts that have swiftly come. So that's the point you're talking about, right? This idea just operated on that assumption.
Yeah, because this term moral hazard has been bandied around forever now, but it's generally been thrown out at investors. You know, investors figured that the stock market would get bailed out if things ever got a bit squirrely, and the Fed would come to their rescue with rate cuts if markets ever got, risk assets ever got kind of wobbly. But that moral hazard has now infected the most basic underpinning of the banking system here, right? You give people return on their money for the use of their money. And the thing that really struck me when all this happened and we had another one of these banking crises, another one that wasn't going to happen in Janet Yellen's lifetime, so it was quite amazing to see her testifying about it from beyond the grave. But the fact that this was actually happening and that this was the way that these guys had dealt with it, I just found that really, really interesting, Steph, because it does labor the point that the banking system is inherently fragile. You know, the fractional reserve banking system is born fragile because you cannot lend $9 out for every dollar of deposits you have and not be fragile. It just so happens that that fragility is rarely exposed. And when it is, and I went back through the FDIC stuff and pulled up the charts of, you know, failed banks, and it happens. We have periods where a whole bunch of banks go under, and guess what? We're still here. The world's still turning. The financial system's still running. So it was curious to see Janet Yellen being grilled by James Lankford, the Oklahoma Republican senator, who I thought did a tremendous job of kind of advocating for his constituents, but more importantly, demonstrating how ridiculous this guarantee for all those deposits has become, because by doing what they did and saving all those depositors in Silicon Valley Bank, they've created a massive, massive problem for themselves now. We should start calling them the Troika again, shouldn't we? The Fed, the Treasury, and the FDIC, the new Troika. Because how do you possibly turn around when any bank now goes under and not guarantee deposits? You know, it kind of would have been okay if this hadn't been called Silicon Valley Bank. If it had been called, you know, First National Bank of the Middle Class, they may have been okay in saying that was an exception. But what do you make of that? I know you saw that testimony. What do you make of Yellen's response to Lankford's questioning about, look, how do you determine what's systemic?
Well, the first point I would get to is your whole comment on how the banking system really rests on confidence at the end of the day. And my main takeaway from her performance was that it served to undermine rather than bolster confidence. And her inability to answer those questions in a way that was really persuasive, made, I think, the problem much worse. And so, you know, we kind of need some serious leadership. But also, and, you know, it's always easy to go back and say, well, they should have done this instead of this. But I'm sure you heard the same thing on the weekend. That Friday when SVB failed, they had the auction over the weekend, the FDIC auction. And I heard that they had several private sector bidders at that auction. But they decided to go ahead with this bailout, which was the dumbest thing. You know, you always want to have a private sector. You can avoid this whole precedent that you're talking about, where now we've got a situation where we have $17.6 trillion in deposits that are undergirded by $128 billion in FDIC insurance. So it's not going to work. But as you said, she's basically set the precedent now where if James Lankford's constituent, some bank in his estate goes bust, she's got to bail them out, you know, to not do that.
You would think, right? Yeah. I mean, I thought the same thing. If I called it the first Farmers Bank of Nowhere goes under, then you've got no choice. I mean, you absolutely have no choice because we live in a populist world, whether you like it or not, and bailing out Silicon Valley at the expense of, you know, farmers or people in the middle of rural America, you just don't have an option now. But the thing that really shocked me with her testimony, Steph, was it just looked so underprepared and as though this whole thing had been really seat of the pants kind of stuff. She didn't sound remotely convincing. And I know that her diction and the cadence of her speech doesn't help her in that, though, so that's fair enough. But when she was questioned, she was absolutely floundering for answers. It wasn't as though she just was kind of getting her words muddled. She just seemed like a deer in headlights, which really surprised me.
But also the manner in which they did this speaks to that. I mean, there was nothing about the way they handled the SVB situation from the FDIC auction and moving forward that gives you any confidence that they had the first clue how they were going to approach it and that they had a game plan and a strategy and they realized that this was a precedent-setting situation, which is mind-boggling. How could you not understand that everyone was going to look at what you did here and extrapolate that across the entire banking system?
Yeah, it's amazing that this has kind of got lost in the whole story, but what did you make of the kind of facility they've set up to allow people to pledge collateral at 100% value to par? What did you make of that? Because it's such a big deal, and yet it seems to have kind of got buried in the noise of depositors and you know, bank closures and mark-to-market assets.
I agree. I'm with you 100%. I mean, I thought that was huge. And it also, to my mind, was like, well, I don't know why we have to answer the question about banks going under anymore, because what problem could they have? If they can pledge their collateral at par, problem solved, right? I mean, I guess, you know, in my mind, the one thing I come back to is that this all, again, would have been moot had those unrealized losses not have to be realized. And I do believe, and this is, you know, sort of a grim outlook, but I do believe that those treasuries and agencies, the treasuries for sure, would be made money good because the economy is going to get slammed so hard that we'll get rates right back down to where they were. And those treasuries will recover their value 100%. So, you know, in this regard, a lot of this in my mind is just kind of a temporary, interesting intellectual exercise that really hopefully won't ever. We won't have to pay the bill for that. I fear the other bills we're going to have to pay. But what do you think about that? I mean,
well, let me ask you while we're on this topic, because, you know, again, this is something you've been warning about for a while and backing up with data that I don't see anybody else kind of bringing forward to argue their case. The case for recession is a strong one. We can see that even though the economy seems to be kind of chugging along, the more it chugs along, the harder it's going to hit the wall, it feels to me. Like there's just going to be a month or a 2 month period where suddenly everyone's sitting there going, hey, what the hell just happened to the economy? Because it's just this kind of weird deterioration under the surface. It's like the foundations are getting eaten away. But these headline numbers are still kind of, unfortunately for the Fed, daring them to not raise rates or daring them to pause. But talk a little bit about when that recession comes, because I when I try and think as a Fed staffer or a decision maker on that board, having been gifted 5%, which is 20, 25 basis point rate cuts, having those back in my pocket after so long, I'm going to be really reluctant to just hose them all over the economy as soon as this thing starts to crack. So how do you think about that? And how do you think that it plays out once the recession hits? Do you think they go full bore, or do you think they try and talk people into it being a gentle recession and hold as much ammunition back as they can?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, I guess it will come back to how much real financial stress they sense, because I don't think they really care if the economy goes into recession. In fact, Powell's basically said there's going to have to be pain on Main Street. It's the financial system. You know, if it looks like we're going to have a series of bank runs and that kind of stuff, that might get them to be more aggressive. But I agree with you. And this is, you know, I'll admit at the front, this is coming from someone who never thought that they would raise rates in the first place. You know,
I thought, amen.
Yeah. I mean, I thought when they proposed that they were going to taper the balance sheet, that they'd be lucky to get through the taper without causing all hell to break loose. And so here we are. I never thought we'd see the most dramatic rate hike since Volcker, or even more dramatic. So that's my true confession. But I guess I agree with you that he's kind of persuaded me that he really wants to preserve his legacy, and he doesn't want to go down as Mr. Pivot from 2018. Yeah. And so he will, barring, I think, some real disruption in the financial machinery, probably try to be more stingy. The question is, how quickly do the wheels come off the economy? And, you know, I keep describing this not as a tightening cycle, but an interest rate shock, because no one had time to acclimate to the first 25 and then the next 50 and then the next 75. It's all hitting at the same time. And that's why I think of that everything everywhere all at once. You know, it's just we're not now 1 year out starting to feel the pinch of the first 25, and then next month we'll feel the next 50. I mean, it's, we're going to hit that wall at 100 miles an hour, is my view. And on the data, I think your point's well taken. And, you know, I go into all these nerdy things beneath the surface. But there's interesting, you know, there's that Citigroup Economic Surprise Index that kind of just does the job for you of looking at how much data surprised on the upside versus the downside.
They really should release that on a different day each month. Just it would be much more in keeping, wouldn't it?
Surprise! Woohoo! Well, Bloomberg, I guess, decided they wanted to have their own index, but they do. What's great about the Bloomberg indices is they have one that looks at survey data, soft data, and one that looks at hard data. And right now, the soft data has collapsed. And it's like, we've only seen it decline to the low level it's at now, like five times in the last 25 years. It's really a dramatic and sharp slowdown. And to me, that portends the hard data following suit. And then the other thing to kind of layer on there is that we did very much unexpectedly have one of the warmest winters in history. And that has really flattered a lot of the data in the near term. So I think beneath the surface, to your point, beneath the surface, the economy is a lot weaker than it looks now. And I think that's going to come to focus in the next couple of weeks as we start moving through that seasonal period and the comparisons get harder and this soft data that's leading starts to be reflected in the hard data too. So that's a nerdy little sidebar for
you. It's funny, you know, when you talk about people not having time to react to the interest rate rise, I was reading a piece down here in Australia last week. You know, there are 25 million people in Australia. And there are 880,000.
How many snakes?
Multiples of that, from what I can gather. multiples of that. And don't even get me started on the spiders. I almost face-planted right into a massive spider's web.
Oh,
thankfully,
dear
I had
God.
My torch on my phone. I held it up, and the spider was about 6 inches from my face. So there's 25 million people in Australia, give or take. There are 880,000 mortgages that are resetting this year. And each one of those is basically getting 10 interest rate hikes in one go.
Wow.
So when you think about, because you know, down here you can't fix for more than 2 or 3 years. I mean, maybe at a pinch you can get five, but you can't fix any longer than that. So literally there are you know, one in 25 for one, there's a mortgage resetting for every 25 citizens in the country within the next year.
What happened with the housing market there? Because I know that had been a big topic that you had been writing about.
Yeah.
This is years ago, about how frothy, they had a huge bubble. Did they ever deflate that at all, or is it still a massive?
No, it's happening. I think prices, last I saw, CoreLogic had them down, I think, 9% this year. New Zealand's fared worse. I think they're down 16% this year, and Canada somewhere in the middle between the two. So it's starting to happen, but you know, still property prices here in Sydney are still, I mean, you wouldn't be able to believe the price of houses down here. Now it's definitely a two-tier market in Sydney. Anything near and within striking distance of the harbour is vastly overpriced, and the further kind of inland you go, kind of in a westerly direction, the more prices fall, and the more they have fallen, because the more they got affordable as anywhere around the harbour increased, the more people moved out there, and the more they stretched themselves to do it. So, you know, it's definitely happening, but not perhaps as quickly and as dramatically as one would think it might do. And if we do start to see a number of mortgages resetting like that, to say to incorporate 10 extra hikes since they last fixed, you know, there could be a significant amount of pain in Australian housing still to come. It wouldn't surprise me. I mean, certainly it's been base case. And just anecdotally, one of the big four banks down here, and there's only four really big banks, is monitoring one-day arrears in mortgage payments while saying everything's fine. I'm not sure why you'd be monitoring one-day arrears if you thought everything was fine.
Yeah. But
the other extraordinary stat I heard was a lender to SMEs that lend money for commercial property secured generally against residential property of the people looking to go into that space. Traditionally, their defaults run at 3%, and currently they're running at 22%.
Wow.
So on top.
Wow.
So those are the kind of, you know, those are the numbers behind the headlines where, and look, Australia is a very property-centric economy. Everybody's wealth is tied up in their house. And so the commentary on housing down here is universally bullish. There's a few guys down here. The one who everybody who's interested in this should be following is a guy called Martin North. He's a phenomenal commentator on the housing market, has every single stat you could ever want. And just anecdotally, you know, the conversations I've had down here with people, it's clear that there are more and more data points, there are more and more anecdotal stories, there's more and more evidence that the housing market is about to hit some sort of wall down here. But I think that that's just a symptom that we're going to see everywhere else. You know, so much of this money's gone into property. And, you know, coming back to the Silicon Valley Bank and the First Republic Bank, you know, when you look at the loan books of the bank industry as a whole, you realize that half the commercial real estate lending is on the books of these small banks, you know, the ones that aren't systemic, supposedly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we saw what happened when First Republic and Silicon Valley went. All the money poured into the big money center banks, so much so that JP Morgan had to put $30 billion back into First Republic. I mean, talk about a shell game.
Right.
So if you look at this whole situation, it's not difficult to connect the dots. You know, the interest rate shock, and I think you're absolutely right, that's exactly what it is going to have these knock-on effects. It's going to make mortgage resets so dramatic that people don't have time to adjust to them, which is going to impair an awful lot of banks' loan books. And those banks are systemic whichever way you cut it. There's just no way around it, because everybody has been encouraged to borrow so much money that every bank is on the hook now. So there's, you know, we have created a wholly systemic problem out of the clear blue sky. And I just, they better hope the economy goes in the tank soon and they've got an excuse to cut rates, because if that doesn't happen, the potential trouble in the banking system is enormous, Steph.
Yeah. Do you think then that we would get to a place where they might actually follow Japan's lead and implement yield curve control to try to bail out the banks with a positive sloping yield curve?
Isn't that what this put facility effectively is?
I guess.
Isn't that some kind of de facto yield curve control? I don't know. I mean, the way when I looked at it, that's what I thought. This is, they're essentially controlling the yield curve for the short end to keep the banks whole. But I can't see any other solution other than some kind of yield curve control. I don't think they'd be crazy enough to do what Japan did and say, right, we're going to peg the 10-year, because it's just such an enormous amount of potential gunpowder I have to use to stabilize that thing.
Yeah.
I think before that, we'll see all the stuff that you've talked about. You know, we'll see pension funds being forced to buy more treasury bills, and we'll see a kind of coercion before we see anything as stupid as we are going to go and peg the yield curve. Because we saw the Aussies try and do it. The Japanese have done it and brought it to an art form where the 10-year doesn't even trade anymore on various days. And we had another day like that this week. But then we saw the flip side of that when the Aussies tried to do it with the 2-year and got blown out the water very, very quickly, abandoned it, quick smart, and we saw the yield triple overnight, more or less. So it's a worrying problem. But that does bring us on to the pension industry. And again, this is something that you've been banging the drum about for so long.
I'm such a broken record, I swear.
No, but if you weren't so entertaining, I'd be bored to death of listening to you talk about this stuff. But you do find a way of making it entertaining.
It's bad enough that I'm writing about pensions, but to write about them incessantly and to just keep harping on it, you know, God, it's a wonder anyone listens to me anymore.
Well,
I think you're the only one.
That's the funny thing, though, Steph, right? You get to the point where people go, uh-oh, damn it, we should have listened to Steph.
God.
So, but let's talk about that. Talk about the state of the pension industry and why this is a problem. Because you have, in all seriousness, and I know your level of humility is quite grating, frankly, but let's put that aside for a minute and talk a little bit about the problems. Because you have written very eloquently about it.
Well, I wouldn't describe it as eloquently, but I will say, you know, again, this is a thing where I'm not... Obviously, I don't need to tell you or your audience, and I'm not a rocket scientist. I think everyone's figured that out by now. But when you just step back and you try to figure out the answer to the simple question, who's going to get hurt the hardest when, you know what, it hits the fan from all these interest rate hikes, it seems pretty clear that the people who are going to get hit the hardest are the ones who were forced to take the most aggressive risk. And that, to my mind, describes the pension funds and the insurance companies, both of which are required, pension funds through, obviously, their return mandates and insurance companies via their annuity products, mostly, to generate sort of 8% style returns in what was a 0% risk-free world for the better part of a decade. So you know that these players all had to go out and buy every junk bond that was issued and every levered loan and every CLO where the levered loans weren't giving them enough juice, and then any private equity, you know, interesting ideas that they'd have to invest in. And actually, CalPERS in 2020, at the depth of the COVID panic, when, you know, rates, which were already ridiculously low, got pushed even lower and the Fed was flooding the system with money, CalPERS announced that obviously it wasn't enough to just buy every toxic asset on the planet. They were going to have to add leverage to their fund, and they were going to take leverage up to something like 20% of assets, which is an insane number for that fund. So it doesn't seem to strain credulity that these guys might actually suffer some pretty big losses when the credit issues all come to the fore. So, and the thing that's scary to me, and you know, I've written about endlessly, Grant, is just the size of the numbers, because the pension funding shortfall today is just under $7 trillion for the U.S. pension system. That's public and private, but the private shortfall is basically nothing, because they've all moved to these defined contribution programs. But so it's all state and local and federal pensions. And, you know, if we're starting, our starting point is $7 trillion, during the dot-com bust and the GFC, the shortfalls basically doubled on average. So if we're starting at 7, we go to 14. You know, suddenly you're talking about some pretty big numbers. Now people are wringing their hands over $2.3 trillion in commercial real estate. That's the regional bank exposure, and that's a big problem. But it's nothing compared to what we could see in terms of a pension bailout if it comes to that. So anyway,
I think you hit the nail on the head there, because these numbers, as you point out, are troublingly large. Yeah, that's almost a positive if you're a policymaker, because they're so large. I just don't think there's any way people can kind of quantify this, right? As you say, $17 trillion in deposits in the system, a $7 trillion shortfall in the pension system, you know, a balance sheet at $8 trillion. I spoke with Felix Zulauf around the tail end of last year, and he, you know, almost as an aside, said, well, look, you know, I think the Fed's balance sheet is going to get to 40 or 50 trillion.
Wow.
And we should just, you know, accept that and realize that that's the direction of travel. And it was obvious that he'd spent an awful lot of time thinking about this, because the way he said it was just very matter of fact.
Right.
And I had a lot of people contact me about it. Did he say 40, 50 trillion or 14 or 15 trillion? When you actually cast an eye around and you look at the problems here and you realize that, as we've seen over the Silicon Valley Bank debacle, the Fed is the only game in town. That's where all this is going to end up somehow. It's going to end up on the balance sheet. You can make a really, really simple case.
Is going to take care of this? You don't think she's got some great plan to deal with all this?
Well, listen, I'm sure she's got a great plan, but it involves faking her own death, I would imagine, and then we're okay to have another financial crisis. Hey, it's been done. John Stonehouse, the MP in the UK in the 70s, faked his own death, left his clothes on a Miami beach, but they found him eventually. But you can't help but look at this. Look at the sheer size of the numbers involved. Look at the Fed's balance sheet. And look, it has to bring us back ultimately to the dollar.
Yeah.
Because no matter which way you cut this, no matter which way you try and slice it, no matter how you want to paint it in glowing light or a gray light, this all comes back to the dollar. And again, you know, the last couple of days, it's so interesting. There was a Fareed Zakaria posted a kind of monologue on CNN about the dollar and hegemony and the kind of BRICS countries looking for an alternative. And then lo and behold, this morning I wake up to a piece on Fox Business.
With my girl.
Same story.
Monica Crowley.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, I posted both of these, and it's always very interesting when you put something like that out there, because I find these things really interesting to think about. And obviously, my point with the first one, the CNN one, was, look, if CNN is having this conversation in prime time on a mainstream show, you can only imagine the conversations, how far advanced they are behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. And I'm always fascinated just the response to something like that, because that was all I said. I didn't say X is going to happen. I didn't say Y is going to happen, and it's going to happen on this day. I just find it very interesting that this is happening, and it makes me realize that this is something that's being talked about, and so we should be aware of it. And the response is, I won't say universally, but heavily skewed towards, this will never happen, this is a waste of time, don't even think about it, which is fine. It's absolutely fine if that's the way you want to believe it. But I can't help but think that if Fareed Zakaria is thinking about this, we should have been thinking about it a long time ago, and many people have. What do you think about the current, I guess, position on the you are here map of the dollar? Because, you know, you and I feel similarly about its long-term prospects.
Yeah.
And I think we get kind of bashed up about our views when people don't quite sequence the timing. But what's your current assessment of the state of it?
I'm terrified. I would say away from my outlook for the economy and the pension debacle and everything that I think is going to happen here, what we're seeing geopolitically right now, I mean, the speed with which this is moving toward a new monetary order is now, I mean, they have pushed the accelerator to the floor. And it was one thing for people on Wall Street and in Washington to kind of ignore the steps that other countries like China and Russia were taking over the last decade, which they have been doing, to diversify away from the dollar, and ultimately in China's case, to create a real alternative to the dollar or somehow end dollar hegemony. But right now what's happening is incredible. I mean, in addition to Xi going to Russia and another meeting with Putin, the fact that he brokered this accord between Saudi Arabia and Iran, to me, is the news of the day. And yeah. I mean, it is so huge, and it's such an important piece in this puzzle, because the only thing, in my view, the only leg that continues to support dollar hegemony in that, you know, is the petrodollar standard. If suddenly Saudi Arabia announces in conjunction with Iran, oh, now we're no longer going to price our oil in dollars. We're going to sell it in yuan, or we're going to sell it in a basket of currency or gold or what have you. It's game over for the dollar. I don't see any other reason why the dollar would maintain its reserve currency status. What's the what function does it play then? What was your view on what's happening there?
Well, the arguments against that are obviously the depth and the liquidity of the Chinese currency, and people will talk about, you know, closed capital accounts, et cetera, et cetera. And that's an absolutely valid concern. But just put a pin in that for a second and come back to Xi brokering this peace deal between Saudis and Iran. You know, I was chatting with James Aitken a little while ago, and he made a point that I just hadn't thought about until he made it. And since he's made it, it started to happen, you know, in real time. It's amazing. And he said, you know, if you think back to the 70s and 80s at the height of American hegemony and dominance, it was Carter bringing Sadat and Begin to the White House for the photo opportunity and bringing these warring factions in the Middle East together, and America as the peacemaker, and America as, you know, the world leader standing as the responsible adult in the room and bringing all these, you know, the sparring kids together and, you know, making them shake hands and walk away. And James said, look, let me pose this to you. What if that role suddenly becomes President Xi, and he's the big man on campus, and he's the guy bringing people together, and it's Beijing where everybody goes to sign accords and sign peace treaties? And lo and behold, you know, literally a matter of weeks after that, we see the exact photo you're talking about. There's Xi in the middle, and, you know, the Saudis on one side, the Iranians on the other side, shaking hands, which, I mean, who had that on their 2023 bingo card? Not many, I would imagine.
Yeah.
So it's a huge change. And these are the signposts that you see them as news, but most people don't have the experience to relate them back to the financial system, because why would they? Who, if they weren't a financial native, would understand the implications of such a handshake? And those implications are exactly what you just laid out there. You know, that if suddenly the Middle East decides that, and let's face it, they don't have to say we won't accept dollars, they just say we're open to other deals.
Yeah.
Because every single one of those dollars that isn't used by a country that doesn't want to use it counts twice, right? It's a dollar that they've got to account for, and it's another dollar they've got to issue in debt to smooth things back at home. So I'm really interested in this story, and it's been going on for a while now, and I'm fascinated by how absolute everybody is on this thing, rather than understanding that it's a journey. It's not a journey to a fixed endpoint, i.e. the end of dollar hegemony. It's a journey to a tipping point, which is unknowable, as to when it suddenly has to accelerate the amount of dollars that get printed in the US to maintain American standards of living. And your girl, Monica Crowley, talked about hyperinflation in the US. You know, I think that may be a bit hyperbolic, but certainly, you know, double-digit inflation is almost baked in the cake if that happens. And so, you know, this is another piece of this puzzle that I think is so important for people to understand and not to just write off. You know, my great friend Brent Johnson talks so eloquently about his milkshake theory. And look, he's absolutely right. There will be an enormous demand for dollars. But in the same way that, you know, this thing back to the financial crisis, when Bear Stearns went under, what was the first thing that got smashed? Gold. Gold plummeted and then went through the roof. You know, when it touched 800, fell dramatically, and then went shooting through $1,000. And so, yes, there may be a rush for dollars, but it may be incredibly short-lived, because the response that the US is going to have to put to losing this constant bid for the dollar from energy-importing nations. So I think it's another crucial piece of the puzzle that it behooves everybody to not get dogmatic about it and not say that the dollar will never lose its place. Yes, it's going to be a hard road, but with every single dollar that is no longer desired by an energy importer, it weakens the foundation significantly, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And the fact is that it has been going on for years and years and years. You know, I track those foreign purchases of treasuries, and they've been withering. Not surprisingly, you know, they first started to go down after we had the dot-com bust and we printed a lot of money to get out of that. And then we took another stair step down after the global financial crisis and all the monetary response to that. So it's not as though the rest of the world is ignorant to the fact that we've been silently defaulting on our debts by debasing the currency. They're very aware of that. And they have been taking measures to sort of reduce their dependence on the dollar, and China most aggressively. So, but as you know, we've talked about, that had been glacial for years. And so people never really took seriously any idea that there could be an end to the dollar's reserve currency status. And I agree with you. It's not as though the dollar will cease to exist. It's just that its role is going to be fundamentally altered. And it creates a whole other issue for us already, because who's going to finance all of our debts? You know, I mean, basically, there's only one constituent right now that can finance our debts, and that's the Federal Reserve, which only amplifies the, you know, depreciation of the dollar and accelerates everyone else's movement away from it. So, I mean, it's unless, as you say, you know, we come out and say, all right, every pension fund has to own, you know, X percent of their assets and treasuries, or I don't know. But I think you're right. I mean, it's really foolish to dismiss what's happening, especially when you see these geopolitical shifts taking place with the clear and stated intention of challenging the dollar's role as the reserve currency. It's not like they're keeping that a secret. I mean, they have,
right.
It's in writing.
Yeah, and it's, you know, the pushback has always been, well, there's no currency that's as deep and as liquid and as appropriate for this kind of function as the US dollar. And that's true. It's absolutely true. But it doesn't mean that you can't create some kind of basket, you can't create some kind of way in which these countries say to themselves, well, look, we're going to actually buy half our oil in our local currency. Because that's all it takes, right? That's all it takes. Yeah. If these countries get together and say, we will set up a common settlement system that enables us all to trade this stuff between ourselves in our own currency. A, you have to understand the incentives there, because if for China particularly, if they're able to print yuan to pay for their energy, that gives them all the advantages that the Americans have had for such a long time.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't have to be, right, the dollar's out, this is in. It's just, look, 25%, 50%, whatever it is, we are going to diversify our income stream if we're the Saudis and say, look, we'd kind of like some euros and we'd kind of like some yuan. And, you know, even if they pick euros and not yuan, well, that changes the composition of foreign exchange reserves around the world, because people will have to hold euros as a part of their reserves more than they do now, perhaps. So I don't know. It's funny. You get something like this bank collapse in Silicon Valley, and you know, already we've seen the ripples going out through the pond. I mean, the fact that Credit Suisse, a 126-year-old bank, which admittedly has been living on the edge, God almighty, they hired me at one point, so that's how risky they are. But to see that swallowed up by UBS in a weekend, and to watch that news flow, to see the Swiss National Bank, to see rumors come out that they would be taken over the weekend. Well, you knew that was a done deal, because there's no way that rumor can come out and not happen. To see how they had to get that done before Asian market hours tells you how global this banking problem is in nature, because why should Credit Suisse going under be a problem for the Asian banking system? Well, because it's in a similar, if not identical, state. So we've just built this enormous system that is vulnerable in all the same places in just about every country, certainly every country in the West. Mm-hmm. And what we're seeing now, whether we like it or not, it's not our place to moan about it. It's just to observe it and try and deal with it, is the unwinding of that. And you know, people term it as a day of reckoning. It's not that at all. You know, it's just the turn of a cycle, and the cycle goes in the other direction, and it moves slowly, and it moves quickly, and then it moves slowly again. But it seems to me that, as we spoke about a few shows ago, the change now is in that famous chart of 10-year yields that yeah. is constantly lower lows and lower highs. That's changed. And if you want to pin one thing up on your wall, pin that chart up. And if we are now in a period of higher highs and higher lows, ultimately, and that does not by any means preclude the idea that they are going to slam things to the floor again mm-hmm. When the recession comes. But inflation's here. And inflation, the absence of it, has been the only thing that's allowed them to get away with everything they've gotten away with for 20 years, because there was nothing on the other side to hold their feet to the fire when they enacted these policies. Now there is. And as soon as you start using the playbook they've been using, you're going to see it on the other side of the coin. I don't know, Steph. I just don't see a no landing scenario. I still can't even believe people right. are talking about a no landing. I mean, that's just, I mean, honestly. But I look for a possible way that there can be some kind of soft landing. And I just don't see it. Maybe you do. And if you do, you know, in the name of all that's super and terrific, please tell me what it is.
Explain it to me. Right. No, I can't explain it to you. I can't. No, I agree with you. And in fact, this is why I find it so laughable that the market rallies on the expectation that the Fed's going to pivot. Like, all this stuff means the Fed's going to have to cut rates sooner. Well, how do you think that that's going to help? Like, that isn't going to be a solution. It's not going to send asset prices back to the moon again. Like, you know, your point about we're having a cycle, it's a cycle, but we're like spoiled kids. We only like the cycle when it's expanding, but when it's time for it to contract, all of a sudden everyone says, no, we need the Fed to cut rates and renew balance sheet expansion and whatever, because we are never allowed to feel any modicum of pain or to flush out the excesses that have been built up. So, I mean, I'm with you. I think that, the markets will be in for a big surprise if they're expecting that all of a sudden it's going to be the same thing again, where the Fed, backs off of the rate hikes and all of a sudden stocks go back up and the economy has a no landing or a soft landing or whatever kind of landing. I think that's fairly fantastical. And, the dollar situation obviously greatly amplifies that. So
the fact that this whole idea of a no landing was actually not only floated in the first place, but so eagerly repeated by people, told me so much about where everybody's positioned and how everybody kind of needs this thing to go now, because it's such a farcical notion yeah. as to be almost ridiculous, you know, that the economy could have a no landing and just get straight back to crazy growth. But this brings me to the other thing I wanted to talk to you about, and that is an article yesterday or maybe the day before. I'm all over the place with days here because it's yesterday there and it's tomorrow here, and I have no
idea
what's going on.
You have an excuse, at least. I don't.
But there was an article in Bloomberg about the VC industry talking about potential haircuts of 25 to 30% on a $2 trillion industry. And this is another thing, and it's this has been the least super and the least happy hour. It's been terrific, but it's been the least super and the least happy I think we've ever done. But I think all this stuff needs talking about, Steph. This private equity problem, right? Because the other part of this, obviously, is in a world of much more expensive capital, private equity, and particularly the way it's been marked for the last number of years, mm-hmm. starts to come under scrutiny. And when you do, as this Bloomberg article said, and they talked about a potential $500 billion markdown in private equity portfolios. And look, nothing I've seen in terms of valuations makes that sound fanciful to me. But I wonder what your thoughts were on the dangers posed by private equity and venture capital funds.
Well, you wrote a tremendous piece about that several weeks back. So I would encourage people to read that, because it was really covered it very well and in much better detail than I could offer. I mean, to me, it all seems fairly opaque. You know, we don't have much visibility into the pension, into the private equity area. But the one thing that I keep coming back to is the extent to which they probably were highly supportive of the zombie corporations. You know, these startup corporations, which I assume are pretty much these zombie corporations that really subsist on an endless supply of cheap credit because they don't have any earnings. And so once that cheap credit disappears, as it has, they start to encounter problems. And then the question is, you know, what happens in terms of, are the private equity guys still exposed there, or have they already offloaded this onto some unwitting pension fund or taken it public, or what's going on there? And again, you know, to me, that's all kind of opaque. I can only quantify how big the zombie market is. And I do understand that the pension sector has aggressively invested in the private equity space. So I assume that they'll have double hits because they'll be exposed to the zombies to the extent they're already, you know, publicly traded, and they'll also be exposed via their private equity exposure. But please, you wrote so eloquently on that. I'd love to hear your thoughts on how that unravels.
Well, I think if you dig into it, it's extraordinary how the tentacles of VC and private equity have gone everywhere. And for very understandable reasons, right? Because these guys are able to mark their own homework, as it were. You know, these guys can decide what their companies are worth. And, you know, there's been this merry-go-round of marking these things up, selling them on, marking them up, selling them on, you know, all amongst the same group of people, and dragging pension fund money into that because private equity became the place to be. You know, and it's funny how this works, right? You start making great returns and everybody wants a piece of the action. And of course they do in a zero world where you can't actually be paid 5% to sit and wait like you can now. But we've kind of reached the end of that particular ride where now, you know, private equity firms are setting up new companies where they're a minority owner and they're selling the company to themselves and bringing in other investors to kind of fill the pot up. It's just you can see it's gasping for oxygen, understandably so. And look, it's become a massive, massive part of the financial system. You know, you showed a fantastic chart in a recent piece you wrote, which showed the growth of the shadow banking system versus traditional banking system. And when you look at that chart, and you look at the problems that we're seeing in the traditional banking system, you realize just how significant the problem really is, because all the money has gone into the shadow banking system. And, you know, and private equity is a big, big part of that. You know, the venture capital is a big, big part of that. And so you cannot have money, the multiples of which has gone into the traditional banking system, go into a space that is completely opaque, has no, its feet aren't held to the fire in terms of marks. And suddenly you realize there's a huge air pocket under the last valuation and the valuation they next get forced to put in place. You know, look, it's just another potential problem, but an enormous one because it's sucked in so much capital over the last 10, 15 years.
Well, at the end of the day, isn't that really what brought down Silicon Valley Bank? Was that was their main customer?
Yeah.
Were these private equity companies? Yeah.
Yeah, and look, the companies had a crazy amount of cash on deposit at Silicon Valley. And some of the numbers of the firms that had, you know, billions of dollars in cash sitting in accounts at Silicon Valley, I don't quite understand, but that's their problem, not ours. but it works every way, right? Because the companies that can't afford funding have to draw down on the cash reserves they've got, which means they have to cut staff, which means they have to shrink their businesses, yada, 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 and on this thing goes. It doesn't require an awful lot of in-depth financial knowledge to see how the dominoes fall from here, as long as you can accept the first domino toppling, right, which is the importance of this interest rate shock. Mm-hmm. If you accept that that is a problem, and you don't look at face value and go, well, nothing's broken yet. We've had a bank go down.
Right, therefore nothing will. Right.
Therefore it's fine. If you actually can accept that there's no way you can have interest rates rise at the speed they have, the distance they have, particularly in a financial system that's set up the way it is with so much debt. If you accept that first step, the dominoes topple pretty easily, and it doesn't take a genius to figure out how it all goes, but every one of those dominoes is a shock to an awful lot of people who cannot reconcile that first domino of the damage that dramatically higher rates in a short period of time do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Does. Yeah, one of the two.
No, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I'd like to imagine that people are now waking up to this or have been woken up by this banking crisis, because I guess most people were shocked to discover that banks were sitting on these unrealized losses at the same time they were letting their deposit base wither because they weren't raising deposit rates. So that seemed to catch everyone by surprise. To me, the next shoe to drop will be these zombie corporations who, by definition, to be a zombie, couldn't service their debt out of their existing operations. And that was before the Fed took interest rates up in unprecedented fashion. So if a junk borrower couldn't afford to pay his interest at 4%, how's he going to do it when his debt rolls at 9%? You know, I assume that that entire swath, it's $1 trillion in debt combined, is just going to evaporate. That is my sense. And then the question is, who's left holding the bag on that? But so we'll have a lot of fun stuff to talk about over the next few months, I suspect.
Ain't that the truth? Ain't that the truth?
Oh,
ain't
man.
That the truth? I mean, look, I think we know who's going to ultimately hold the bag. It just depends how successful they are in doing that and at what point they cry uncle. But that is a story for another day, my dear Stephanie Pombo.
Well, so we did get some, or you got some yada, yada, yadas in there. So we did pay obeisance to the Seinfeld gods here.
We did. I did get a yada, yada, yada in there. I did. And that's enough, apart from the title of the show. Well, look, it's an absolute joy always to talk to you. Thank you so much for
doing
this.
Pleasure is mine.
In the middle of an afternoon over there in sunny Florida, I am off to dodge the snakes again today and the spiders.
Oh my gosh.
So if I don't make it back, you know what's happened to me. I've been bitten by something and probably
don't even joke
somewhere.
About that.
Oh. All right. Well, listen, if you don't follow Steph already, I'm going to do this plug for you, Steph, because I know how hopeless you are at doing it. If you don't follow Steph, you should follow her on Twitter. She will find her at @spomboy. And everything she tweets is worth reading. And if you haven't checked out macromavens.com, you should also do that, because you won't find a smarter, more humble, and more fun to read analyst anywhere in the world. And you know I'm going to cut this off, so don't even bother saying
right,
anything
self-deprecating.
I have the ultimate power of edit. I have the ultimate power of edit, and you will be chopped short.
I know you are, Steph, but when am I?
Yeah, right. Steph, thank you so much. Let's do this again sooner rather than later. What do you say?
Sounds like a plan. I'm looking forward to it.
All right. Toodaloo.
Bye.
Nothing we discussed during the Super Terrific Happy Hour should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, to say nothing of super and terrific, of course, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.